see there are four panel members here, so I'm sure they all want to get a chance to talk, and I'm sure you guys have questions for all of them, so we'll just get started here. My name is Hanneke Breumans. I'm the environment reporter at the Edmonton Journal, which is in Alberta, Canada, that is immediately north of Montana here. And I write about the oil sands. You'll hear me call them oil sands. Some people on the panel will call them tar sands. It's the same thing. I write about the oil sands a lot, especially the last few years. It's been an escalating issue for a number of reasons. Some of you may not have a good idea of the size of the oil reserves in Alberta. It represents about 170 billion barrels, and that is second to Saudi Arabia's reserves, so there's a lot of oil there, and we know that the U.S. likes to deal with us. I think the vast majority of the oil from the oil sands goes to the U.S., so, you know, that's an important customer to us. I could tell you that in the last few years, environmentalists and indigenous groups have raised a lot of concerns having to do with air, land, and water issues that they perceive to be major problems with the oil sands. And here in the States, too, environmentalists have been raising issues. I mean, you've probably heard about the Keystone Pipeline, and there's some pressure to not have that project go ahead, I guess, for various reasons. You probably heard about the spill in the Kalamazoo. That was from Alberta, that oil. And, of course, even here in Missoula, my friend Clint pointed this out to me today. On the front page, there's a story about some of the vessels that are the process vessels that have to move through Idaho and Montana to get up to Alberta. They're manufactured in South Korea, and it's a long ways away. And they're, you know, there's people that are concerned about, I guess, you know, they're traveling over historic roads and so forth. So they're concerned about what the impact of that might be. So obviously, these are a lot of widespread issues that we can discuss here today. I'd just briefly like to introduce the panel. You may be a little confused if you're looking at the program that you have, because there were a couple little hiccups. The first is that, unfortunately, David Schindler could not make it. He had a medical emergency in his immediate family, and unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. However, Peter Hodgson here has rescued me by agreeing to take part in the panel. He was involved in the research that David Schindler would have discussed. He's a co-author on those papers produced in the last 10 months. He is a biology professor from Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. Seated right next to him is Preston McEachern. He's a scientist who works for the government of Alberta. He's head of research science and innovation there. And I'm sure he'll be talking about some of the research that the government is doing related to contaminants and so forth in the oil sands region. Next to him is Andrew Logan. He's the oil program director for CERES, a group that is interested in getting environmentally and fiscally and socially sound investments done. And seated right next to him, last but not least, is Janet Ainslie, and she is Vice President of Communications for the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. So I'm sure they each have a little more to say about why they've so kindly agreed to be on the panel today, and we'll just start with Peter Hodgson.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? I just wanted to extend greetings from David. He was very sorry he couldn't be here for very understandable reasons. Those of you who know David will realize that I'm probably a very pale imitation of the real thing, so hopefully I'll be able to give you the message that he would have given. So, as Hanneke mentioned, we were part of a team that published two papers in Proceedings of the National Academy of Science that describe the distribution of chemicals around the tar sands extraction processes in the tar sands area itself. And
push the microphone closer to you, please.
Certainly. Is that better? Everybody here now?
Yes.
My apologies. So why did we do it? Well, in part because of the concerns for downstream communities. Those were concerns that were very heartfelt, based on human health issues, concerns about the quality of water, air, the food they're eating from the country, et cetera, et cetera. Their whole way of life appears threatened, as well as their health. And those particular concerns were effectively rebuffed by the provincial government. So time and again, we heard provincial officials, particularly the politicians, say, well, no, this really isn't a problem. There are no emissions, nothing different to background. Everything you see is contributed by normal erosion of the tar sands as the river, Athabasca River, passes through it and flows north. And from a common sense point of view, this didn't make or cut any ice with us, because if you look at the pictures, if you look at the size of the operation, you look at the extensive area that's being mined, it's inconceivable that there would not be a release of chemicals out of the landscape. Everything we do, whether it's agriculture, urban development, or even just sitting in this room, we're the cause of the release of chemicals. So your transportation here, the paper you consume, the food you've consumed, our own little human waste, we all leave a chemical fingerprint no matter what we do. So to look at this giant operation and say there are no emissions above background just seemed inconceivable. So in some respects, for scientists, it was like waving a red flag in front of a bulb. So we managed to find some support to do a one-year project in which we demonstrated fairly clearly that there is a chemical fingerprint on the landscape. It showed up in the snow in the winter very, very clearly. It showed up in the water that was upstream and downstream of the developments. That is, we could distinguish the background concentrations of chemicals that were out there from the chemical concentrations being added by these various industrial activities. And the significance of this work was that, of course, it tended to contradict the government ministers. I think it made them not too happy, and they continued to deny everything left, right, and center, including as recently as a week or so ago. Most importantly, it validated the concerns of the people who live downstream, the communities that are most affected, and it clearly illustrated that perhaps our monitoring and control efforts are not adequate for this particular job, that we need to do a better job as a society in monitoring, assessing, and controlling the release of these chemicals to the environment.
Thank you.
So pass that to...
Yes, please.
So I appreciate being here, and I will, when happy, I hope you have a lot of questions about the stuff that has come up. I will address a few things that Dr. Hudson just led off with here, which was that the first is this premise that the government has said there are no contributions from the industry. That's absolutely false. The government of Alberta, if it's been reported that way, certainly has never said that, because we license discharges from these facilities. To say that there are none, after we've gone through a licensing process and have publicly available data cataloging those discharges, is just silly. So yes, we acknowledge that there are contaminant contributions from the oil sands industry. We're well aware of them. They report them as regularly as daily coming off some of their stacks. That's just as you do down here with SEM systems on your power generation facilities. We do that there too. So we know what's going out in the air. We know what's depositing on the land. We have a lot of work that goes on in terms of monitoring. Where the difference in context comes forward is that there is a large, large contribution from natural sources. The river flows through the oil sands formation. It's right there at the surface. And we've seen, as well as has other independent researchers published in peer-reviewed literature, the contribution from the natural load is very large relative to the more recent industrial loading. And when you put these things together and you look downstream in the Athabasca River, you generally cannot see increases above background. Getting to the human health aspect of this, background being that natural load, it is so large relative to the industrial load that you just can't piece it out, especially with the variability in this river. That's not to say it's not happening, and we acknowledge that, and we do a lot of work around it. We have a very extensive monitoring program, a government one, as well as an industry-funded one through RAMP, which is highly criticized for a number of good and not-so-good reasons. primarily based on what it was meant to achieve versus what it's expected to achieve, but we can go into that a little bit later on. Is the downstream health impacts. I believe that even in the work that was done by Kelly and colleagues, that in the Athabasca River, you do not see guideline exceedances that are any more prevalent than what you would see upstream or in that region, based on the 40 years of historic data that we have. You would expect to see a much greater increase, particularly as development has proceeded. You don't see those. We haven't seen increasing trends in contaminants in this river after 40 years of monitoring, and that is because we're doing a very good job with managing these discharges. Process-affected water, as an example, is not allowed to be discharged from these facilities. It's stored in tailings ponds, which has the negative, unfortunate effect of having these humongous tailings ponds out there, now at 170 square kilometers, 170 million meters, square meters, right? Massive environmental, potential environmental challenge, which we are now dealing with through a tailings management framework. But, you know, you solve one problem, you create another, and this is a very, very large and very, very complex industrial development. And so to try and whittle it down to very simple sound bites is quite difficult to do.
Thank you.
Great. Well, I'm going to, I think, broaden things out a little bit. I'm Andrew Logan with Ceres, as I guess my tag says. And for those of you who don't know, Ceres is a nonprofit coalition of institutional investors and environmentalists. And we work on issues like climate change or water scarcity that are both important environmental issues, but that also have the potential to impact the economy and long-term shareholder value. And the investors in our coalition are quite large. They represent about $10 trillion in assets. And they're also very long-term in their focus. Many of them are pension funds who are investing on behalf of beneficiaries who won't retire for many decades. So it's interesting, we'll be around, our investors will be around in this resource long after the current set of CEOs and policymakers is long gone. And again, for our investor members, the oil sector is an important part of their holding, so they very much want the industry to do well. So we're not anti-oil sands, we're not pro-oil sands. You know, in a debate that is very polarized and very black and white, we are firmly in this very messy middle ground, I think sometimes seemingly all by ourselves. So while we're not anti-oil sands, I think we are quite concerned with the current way the oil sands have been and are being developed. You know, the concern really is that the industry is investing and has invested tens of billions of dollars in this resource without, from our perspective, without a well-articulated, clear plan for managing the environmental risk and environmental liabilities that come with oil sands development. You know, the concern really is a bottom-line concern. You know, the oil sands, the economics of the oil sands are somewhat tenuous to begin with at current oil prices. You know, Goldman Sachs put out a report last year looking at the economics of this, and they said this is the most expensive source of new oil in the world. But, you know, you can make money at current prices if you just look at the cost of capital, the cost of building these projects, and the cost of extraction. You know, our concern is once you begin to layer on these other costs, so costs for carbon, which we know is coming, if not soon, certainly over the lifespan of these multi-decade projects, the costs associated with dealing with water scarcity, which is increasing concern in Alberta, the costs with associated with cleaning up tailings ponds and reclaiming land. You know, land reclamation can cost, you know, upwards of $100,000 a hectare, and you think about the amount of area we're dealing with, the costs are quite high. And yet, because of some loopholes in the way the accounting rules work, none of that actually is disclosed to investors. So the scale of the liabilities and really the full cost and economics of oil sands development are fairly opaque. So you know, really, what investors want is to see the companies who are thinking about this, you know, in a holistic way from soup to nuts. Not just can you make money in the next couple of years pulling this oil out, but if you as you deal with the very profound environmental and social impacts, which are quite expensive, you know, does the economics really still add up? And again, I think what we're seeing gives us some pause. I mean, just to look at three issues very, very quickly, you know, these are water-intensive projects in a part of the world that is dry and getting drier, and yet you look at the industry and, you know, only half of companies even disclose how much water they use. Only a quarter have any goals for managing water use, which is, you know, quite concerning. these are carbon-intensive projects in a world, you know, again, where over time carbon will have a cost, and yet only a handful of companies, maybe one or two, have any public target for managing their emissions. You know, and similarly on the tailings front, you know, we know that the cost will be in, you know, in the billions of dollars to deal with these things, but again, because of the way the accounting rules work, essentially that is carried on the balance sheet for companies as zero. So, you know, I think what we're looking for is a frank conversation about the scale and scope of the problems and what the solutions are and how we can accelerate those solutions going forward. You know, I think, you know, our worry is that the industry is really hoping or relying on the hope that technology will save the day. But yet, if you look at where, you know, the amount of R&D spending and the amount of progress we've seen, at least in some areas on the technological front, there's not a lot of reason to necessarily be optimistic. So, you know, just to close, you know, again, our perspective is that the long-term financial sustainability of the oil sands depends on them being made environmentally sustainable. And you know, what we're seeing now doesn't give us huge confidence that we're going to get there anytime soon.
Thank you, Andrew.
My name is Jana Danisley. I'm the Vice President of Communications with the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. I'm also, I used to be a student here at University of Montana, so it's wonderful to be back and see Missoula. It's such a beautiful city. And I want to extend a thank you to the organizers and to Henneka, and I'd like to also say thank you to the First Nations and Native Americans on whose traditional land we are here today. Very lucky as a Canadian to be here in the United States, so thank you very much. I am a Canadian. I'm a native Albertan. I was born and raised in Calgary. I've known about the oil sands since they were tar sands the first time, which is actually what they were called when they were actually used to tar roofs and tar roads. And as technology improved and we became able as an industry to actually manufacture oil out of this material, they became oil sands. And back in 2002, our world changed. It changed fundamentally in Alberta when the U.S. Department of Energy declared the oil sands both economically and technically viable. And what that did is it catapulted the actual reserves of Canadian oil from somewhere down in ninth place to in second place globally. So basically overnight, we went from having, I think, what most people considered a difficult resource, an impossible resource perhaps in northern Alberta, that suddenly became half of the remaining investable oil remaining in the world. So if you look at all the oil in the world that's held in Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Iran, Iraq, all those countries, the OPEC countries where they have state-run oil companies, where they have perhaps military dictatorships and other regimes, half the oil in the world, or a lot of oil in the world is there, but half of the remaining investable oil in the free world is in Canada, is in Alberta, Canada. So that has put us in a tremendous position. And one where I think my members, we represent 90% of Canada's oil and gas production. We're not, we don't represent $10 trillion in funds, but we are a $110 billion a year industry in Canada. We have over 100 members, big and small, many of whom work in the oil sands. I worked for an oil sands company for more than 10 years. So I've been knee-deep in oil sands. I've been to in-situ sites. I've been all over. I've been to First Nations communities. I've done community consultation. I've been held. I've been hugged. I've been yelled at. All of the above. And I think when I come to this, I come to it that we are in this together. My members feel like we're in a very hard place. The world needs energy, more of it every day. Energy needs, according to the International Energy Agency, are predicted to double in the next 40 years. And against that, we live in a world where the easy oil we have is declining. So how are we going to meet those energy needs going forward? And certainly as we look today, globally, only a very small percentage of our total energy comes from renewables. So over the short term, certainly the demand and the potential supply comes from so-called unconventional sources like oil sands. So oil sands is one. There's also unconventional gas. You've heard a lot about that, shale gas, particularly in places like Pennsylvania and New York. There's issues associated with that. But as we sort of dig deeper into the hydrocarbons we have, things become technically and also therefore economically and environmentally much, much more challenging. But fundamentally, as a Canadian, I think we're in an interesting position. We had a Hollywood director, James Cameron, up to the oil sands a couple weeks ago, and he was looking at this resource, and I think he actually, I shouldn't say actually, but he said a very smart thing. He said that this resource could be a blessing or a curse. And I believe that as well. And I think that as Canadians, we do have the opportunity to turn it into a blessing. That this is a resource where royalties and taxes are collected. Those royalties and taxes go back to the people of Alberta. We live in a democracy. We live in a place where people are well educated. We do invest in technology. We do protect our environment. We monitor the environment. Are we perfect? Not by any stretch. Do we want to be better? Yes, we do. When I look at the proof points that we have in the oil sands and compare it to other industries and certainly our other oil options globally, we have reduced CO2 intensity in the oil sands by 40% since 1990. And when you talk about things like the cost of carbon, again, our industry is ahead of the curve because we have a cost of carbon in Alberta. $15 a ton is what it's been put at for the time being. So we've actually looked to include some of these costs in the business model. Our regulator has insisted that we include some of these costs in our business model, that we carry reclamation costs as liabilities. And when it comes to water, certainly we have room to improve on use of the water, both the quantity of water we use and the quality of the water, perhaps that we release. All the water that we do release to the environment currently meets government standards. But we're open to new information if those standards need to be improved. And on the First Nations front and on human rights, in the oil industry, we don't have the purview to grant rights to people. We work within the law of Canada. We work with First Nations, we believe, in a very productive and good way. Recently, for example, an oil company was very successful in working with the First Nations to resolve some of their socioeconomic concerns and to their satisfaction, and actually that First Nation withdrew their concerns from our hearing process. So again, an example of where people that are solution-oriented can work together and find options that fit our mutual interests. And in areas like tailings, we do have a lot of work to do, but the significant R&D in tailings alone, $1 billion this year, has been spent in terms of reclamation research and development. So are we perfect today? No. But do we want to do better? Yes. Do we have the technology, the people, the talent, and fundamentally the institutions and the structures? I think so. But certainly we depend on the good people in the media and the good people in academia and the government to also tell us how they think we're doing.
Okay. Thanks, Janet. I think that kind of gives you guys an overview of where these panel members are coming from. I would like to get in a few discussion points before we open it up to the floor here. First, I'd like to ask the panel, and you can each respond if you choose, what role do you think science should play in how the resource is developed, and how should that science be approached? Like, where should it come from, and who needs to make the, how should the decisions be made on how that, whether that science is accepted or not. So I think I'll just start with Peter here, and we'll move down if you guys have comments or not.
Thank you. That's a very important question, because one of the obvious things is that the difference in outlook on this situation between the government of Alberta, the industry, and some of the science community who are arguing that there really are bigger problems than are acknowledged relates to the quality of the scientific data, and also relates to the approach to which you undertake monitoring and collect data in a scientific way. And one of the things that has become quite obvious in the last few years is that there is very much a conflict in the monitoring program between those who run it and the outcome. That is that it's a program that's paid for by industry. It's run, of course, by a community group, supposedly, with industry, government, and native communities involved in some of its oversight. But clearly, it is paid for by the industry. So it has the appearance of the fox guarding the chickens. And that's aggravated even more when we see that the Alberta government has invested in the oil sands. They put up recently a major investment in a new upgrader facility that's supposed to be partnered with an industry in the extraction side. And, of course, you have to ask yourself the question, how can the government honestly guard the environment while at the same time trying to promote tremendous investment in extracting oil from the oil sands? There's a clear conflict of interest. So what we're arguing on the science side is that the program should continue as it is, or not as it is, but in a modified way. But the most important modification should be that it achieve some kind of, or be given some kind of scientific oversight by an independent science body. That is a body that is capable of making scientific decisions, is not connected to the government, is not connected to the industry, but has the capacity to work independently and give that monitoring program the sense of independence and give people confidence in the data that it generates.
I'd agree 100% with Peter on this one. The critical point that seems to get missed is that the regional aquatics monitoring program, which Peter was just referring to, is just one component of monitoring in the region. Not to slag my colleagues there at the regional aquatics monitoring program, which I participate in, but it's really not even close to the most important from an Alberta government perspective. The one that's important is the stuff that's held in regulatory approvals. That's the legal stuff. That's where we get to charge them $1 million every time they have an exceedance. So that's the stuff that's important to us. That's site-specific. And then the government of Alberta has a very extensive monitoring program that provides the assurance that what we're getting reported from those approval conditions from industry is indeed correct. We have compliance systems in place. None of this is ever really brought to the forefront, but it is part of a very, very tightly regulated process in the oil sands, and that shouldn't be missed. The Regional Aquatics Monitoring Program is great. It had some very simple objectives. It achieves those well. The major problem is that there's expectations that are much greater, and part of the problem is that we haven't done a good job of communicating how the other monitoring programs that occur in the oil sands actually fill those roles.
Sure, I don't know that I have too much to add. I guess the only thing I would say is, you know, I think there's probably a critical need for a greater focus on the cumulative impact of development of the oil sands. I think there are processes in place that at least in theory regulate the impact of any individual project that goes forward. But I think, you know, the real impact on water, on air, on biodiversity and landscape is at a cumulative industry-wide level. And, you know, there are scientifically identifiable limits to, you know, how much water you can draw from the watershed, how much land you can develop before biodiversity is critically impacted, you know, how many pollutants you can put in the air before you impact human health. So I think that is what's sometimes missing is this focus on the broader picture and how do we regulate and control the impacts of development of the industry as a whole in a way that is scientifically based and sound. And, you know, certainly the idea of doing that in a way that is independent, you know, as Peter suggested, is good. But just that's, I guess, the only point I would make.
Can I make one comment on that?
Many of you probably are aware that both our Premier and the Minister of Environment heard that recommendation from Kelly and colleagues here, and Peter, and announced a science review panel specifically to address those issues. And I just want to bring that forward. And the federal government did as well. They've got a monitoring review committee established with scientists that are both in both cases external to Alberta, and hopefully will provide part of that role that Peter was just talking to.
I would just add, I agree with the majority of the comments here as well. Our members are very clear that we are open to new sources of information, new studies that are brought forward. We look at each and every one. We have our in-house technical experts and scientists look at each and every one and assess the merits. And we've heard a lot of very good ideas coming forward over the last couple of years. I think what we need to do better is we have to find a way to support new science and new research. We talked about industry funding of the research and monitoring bodies. Well, you know, we thought we were doing a good thing by supporting and funding some of these things. And I think now that is being used against us in some ways. And certainly the taxpayers of Alberta say, you know, they don't want to pay for it. They don't want this coming from their income taxes and whatnot to support really what should be a cost borne by industry in some way. So those kinds of systems and mechanisms, the details there need to be worked for sure, but in terms of do we want new science, do we want more information, absolutely.
Okay, great. Andrew, I was wondering, maybe you could start off, and I don't know if other people would like to contribute to this one, but can you talk a little bit about what sort of concrete measures you think, you know, investors should look for in terms of managing the environmental risks to give them some security? Like, can you talk about specific programs and you know, how science-based you think they need to be, or something along that line?
Sure. I mean, I think what we've been asking companies for, I mean, there's kind of three areas, right? One is simply very basically around disclosure. So wanting to understand from companies the full environmental and financial picture of the investments that they're making. You know, we want to we're asking for better disclosure on basically the environmental impact of these projects, the social impact, and what the risks are and how those risks are being managed. And as I said in my opening comments, you know, that has been very spotty is a charitable way of putting it. There's still very little data out there for investors who want to understand who really gets these issues and is doing a good job managing those risks and who is kind of casting them off. So disclosure is kind of a starting point. You know, I think we want to see a much more clearly defined vision for, you know, what a more sustainable development trajectory in the oil sands looks like. You know, again, we hear a lot of kind of basically trust us, technology is coming. This, you know, the oil sands 20 years from now will not look at the oil sands now. And, you know, I think this is an industry where saying trust us doesn't really get you very far. So I think we want to see both a clearly defined endpoint in terms of what that will look like and some clear markers along the way so we know if we're making progress or not, and, you know, so aggressive targets for reducing your impacts across all the areas that we've already talked about. I think as well we see a real important role for companies to push for much better regulation of the oil sands. I think there's a strong business case to be made for better and stronger regulation around water, around greenhouse gas emissions, around toxics, around tailings, you know, around all these issues. You know, again, it's, you know, our sense is that the financial sustainability of this resource depends on much greater progress on the environmental sustainability of the resource. And so even though there are certainly short-term cost implications to putting a higher price on carbon, putting stronger regulation on water use, you know, in the end, the resource simply won't be viable if we, you know, if we run out of water or some of the toxic issues aren't dealt with. So really disclosure, kind of performance targets and public policy. And just to the point we just discussed around science, I think the interesting question to me is not so much where does science come from, but how do you make sure that regulation is firmly grounded in strong science, which I think is a bit of a tougher question.
If everyone's nodding their heads, does anyone want to add to that? Or?
Well, I'm just nodding my head because I've now, working inside of an oil company, spent many, many hours working on disclosure reports and sustainable development reports, and I'm a big fan of disclosure, and for the reasons I think that Andrew outlined, is that we don't live in a trust me world, we live in a show me world, and further we have to show people what we're doing, and a lot of that is through through metrics and through reporting our performance. I think one of the things I like about working at an association is actually looking at the more cumulative picture versus working at a unique one company picture, and I think if we can get to the point where we're reporting transparently for the oil sands industry, the government of Alberta currently collects a huge amount of data that is provided to Albertans and open to the media, some just on the website and some of it can be FOIPed and whatnot, but there's a lot of data out there, but a lot of it is making it transparent and showing the accountability. So where, say, government or industry are trusted to actually be measuring these things correctly, are we audited, do we have third parties involved, et cetera, where's that extra level of scrutiny? So I think some very good points. And again, the industry is set up today to do this because we do it for our regulator. And I think the next step we have to take is to make it more transparent and also have that extra accountability measure in terms of verification.
Preston, Andrew was talking about markers and sort of, and you were nodding your head when he was saying that. I'm just wondering, what are there markers or signs that you think the government should still be working towards or should be making more progress on that would give the outside world this confidence that they seem to be seeking in how the resource is being developed?
This is exactly one of the major challenges, as pointed out. Show us takes some time. And so we've embarked, and this is a science and practical application intensive a component, but we've marched down this path towards a progressive reclamation strategy and trying to establish, say, 10-year benchmarks for completely re-engineered landscapes, replace soils, organic over mineral, replanted, how are you going to grow a forest, but trying to establish some kind of metrics that says, yeah, we're checking this every year, every 5 years, every 10 years, and we're on the right path. That's where the science comes in, and you're dealing with models. I deal a lot, I live in a world of water quality modeling, and I think it's wise for me and everybody else to not really believe the outcome until you start getting data back and use some Bayesian approach or what have you to increase your confidence. But you're doing this stuff incrementally, and it takes time. It was mentioned that, and this is often missed when people talk about the oil sands. We've got 40 years of data, but it really only exploded in terms of development in 2001. So we're really dealing with less than a decade of show me. We have no well-established reclamation at the extensive scale. We have one certified site. That gets focused on without recognizing that we have over 64 square kilometers that are in various states of reclamation. We have a tailings pond, the first one to be reclaimed. It was widely announced back in September. This is a major, major test case of reclamation. We've established some targets, and this is where the science comes in to establish how are we going to ensure that this actually worked and make sure we're on this right pathway over the next 20, 30 years for that site or any other site like it. That is where the science comes in. Quite a lot of researchers involved in that kind of work.
Yes. I think the ideas that Preston just mentioned are very important because the and this has nothing to do with our study. This is just sort of a personal view, and that is that there is a real disconnect between the time scale over which reclamation occurs, during which we collect data on how successful it is, during which we get some understanding of what we can do, how successful we can do, and what the outcome is going to be. And that is totally disconnected from the time scale in which tar sands or the oil sands are developing. We have many world-class oil companies in there already. There are more coming in every day. Total is about to come into the province. The Chinese want to be in the province. Shell, Imperial, Sunil, all are in the province already, developing like mad, expanding the oil sands, and making decisions today, which we won't know the consequences of for, as Preston said, another 10, 20, 30 years. I'm not sure whether our science at the moment is capable of providing the answers that we need in the real time of development to ensure that we don't go down a road that ultimately we regret.
Okay, I don't know if any of this was confusing for you guys. I've been involved in oil sands reporting for so long and I've done so much in the last few years that it's all sort of second nature to me. But I'd like to open the floor to questions now, and I guess I'll find out if you guys are confused or not. There are a few rules, as you guys probably know or remember from previous conferences. Questions should be asked by working journalists first, those and members. Those will get precedence. Also, we ask that you not make a speech. We ask that you ask a question. I've been advised to ruthlessly cut off anyone who is trying to make a speech, so I'm sorry, but I will do that. And also, if you could identify yourself, please provide your name and the organization that you work with. And I will try to, I will repeat the questions, or someone from the panel will repeat the questions, so hopefully everyone up to the back of the room can hear. So, any questions? Start here in the front.
Well, My name is Barbara Bernstein. I'm an independent reporter, radio producer from Portland, Oregon. There was an article on the front page. There's an article on the front page of New Zealand today about controversy about these giant rigs that are getting shipped from Lewiston, where they have just been transported down the Columbia River and the Snake River, and they are now going to travel up Scenic Highway 12 all the way through Idaho and Montana up into Alberta. And my question is, what does this show about the impacts of the tar sands beyond the fields in northern Alberta, and also the scope of the project? Because these rigs are so huge that they are going to have to shut down Highway 12 while they're being shipped because they take both lanes of traffic.
Okay, everyone heard that, so that's that worked out well. Who wants to take that one?
Since it's one of our members who is shipping the modules, I'll talk a bit about, I think there's two things, specifically the modules, and then I think the question about the more sort of far-flung impacts of oil sands development. So the modules are prefabricated units brought over from Asia. There's lots of large infrastructure required to develop the oil sands in Fort McMurray. So unlike we've had other shipments come from other ports, this one's rather unique in that it is coming up the river system and then across these highways and up Alberta. But certainly, as you know, we look at the relationship that Canada and the U.S. have, this is not that unusual. That the oil that, you know, well, there are issues with the transport of those modules that will be regulated by the state and by the authorities who have those responsibilities. There is an environmental impact assessment process underway here in the state of Montana to understand if there's any environmental impacts associated with that transport. And if those are, those will be dealt with. Once those modules get to Canada, they in fact, I think as Haneke alluded to earlier, is they're being used to produce oil. Once they get to my province, they're being used to produce oil that's coming back down here to the United States. So it's very much an interdependent relationship that we have. And we need to make sure all aspects along the value chain, along the way, are managed appropriately. But it is certainly an interdependent relationship.
Okay. You were next, I believe.
Okay.
I don't know if you
want to.
It's pretty short.
I'm Don Corrigan with a suburban newspaper group in St. Louis, Missouri. A number of Midwest newspapers have questioned the quality of the pipelines that are delivering this material, and there's more concern about the integrity of these pipelines. And one of the things that they've said in these reports is that the companies have chosen cheaper pipe from China instead of buying, and this gets to be sort of a U.S. issue with where you buy your goods and stuff. But they said there's better pipeline available in the United States, but some of these companies have cheaped out, and now there's concern about this. I'm just wondering, how many pipelines are there from this area, and what is the integrity of those pipelines?
Well, I don't speak for the pipeline industry, and nor can I speak in terms of what the specifications are in the United States. FERC is the regulator for pipelines in the United States, so I think you've raised some very good issues about the pipeline requirements, what is required. I know that there's, you know, Buy American issues in there, but where the steel comes from, you know, how much labor will be actually employed in America in order to get the maximum economic benefits out of these large infrastructure projects as well. But certainly on the regulatory side, I'm sorry I'm not able to answer that question, but it is an important question to be asking of pipeline regulators in the United States.
I wanted to comment on that as well, because I think Canadians are equally concerned. Since the evolution of the argument about dirty oil in the United States, there has been an obvious recognition by industry in Canada that perhaps the market's not quite so assured as we thought. The result has been that Encana has proposed a major pipeline between Kitimat and Edmonton to take Alberta's oil, in this case probably heavy oil derivatives, to China. So here we have a major pipeline being proposed going through an area of some earthquake-prone regions, very steep mountains, incredible river crossings, a lot of snow slides because of a very heavy snow area, and delivering the oil to part of the BC coast, which is regarded as one of our more sensitive ecosystems and where we now have a moratorium on oil drilling. So the potential outcome of this move in the States for dirty oil is that We don't lessen environmental impacts by reducing the industrial activity. Rather, we just require Canadian industries to push for markets overseas, and the potential environmental impacts get shifted from pipelines in the United States to pipelines in Canada. So same kind of concerns, but now in a different kind of ecosystem. And the other thing, of course, too, is that if I was an oil drilling company off the West Coast or wanted to drill off the West Coast, I'd be saying, well, okay, if you can transport big ships through the Queen Charlotte's, why the hell can't we drill oil offshore? And, of course, opening up an area right now which is protected. So I think there's kind of some big picture implications of these questions about pipelines and where the oil goes.
Well, I would only add maybe to the question that was asked a bit earlier about kind of the how this is having an impact in the U.S. I mean, I think it's interesting to think about, even though the oil sands have been around for 40 years, I mean, they're really in a very early stage of development in terms of the production. Right, we're at, 1.3 million barrels a day, something like that, potentially tripling if the industry's projections are to be believed over coming decades. And so, you know, I think we're already seeing impacts in the U.S. around pipeline construction, lots of impact around refinery expansion and refineries being retooled to process the heavier crude in the Great Lakes areas or in the south, and you know, the issue around the heavy haul and the modules. So I think, you know, I think we're only beginning to see, you know, I think for a long time the oil sands was something that was a bit over the horizon in Alberta. People kind of didn't pay attention to it except when they saw it in the news, but I think it is going to begin to have more of an impact in everyday life, and I think it does speak to, you know, frankly, the poor job the industry has done, the fact that that this product has gotten such a tainted reputation in the U.S. It really is viewed in many quarters as dirty oil. I mean, the fact that you had a Republican senator in Nebraska come out yesterday in opposition to this pipeline, or at least expressing a lot of concerns about this pipeline, is interesting, and I think it says a lot about the need for a more frank discussion about solutions, I guess is what we've been saying.
Did you have a journalist?
Let's
have a journalist finish, please. Another journalist?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry, you in the back there?
I believe it was Jeff that said something about...
Sorry, can you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Amelia Ackerman, and I'm a journalist from the
or not, but it has to do with lawsuits against the government and industry having to do with critical habitat for woodland caribou.
I think it's critical habitat for woodland caribou and also the other constitutional rights that First Nations in Canada have related to traditional land use. So in Canada, under various treaties that were signed between the Crown and First Nations, and actually Canada is the only country in the world to actually enshrine Aboriginal rights in our constitution. So when energy companies are looking to develop resources in areas where First Nations have for millennia, for 10,000, 20,000 years, hunted and fished and gathered, we work oftentimes very directly with those First Nations to understand their concerns. Their concerns are social, they're economic, they're environmental. Where possible, the way our system in Canada is set up, the first option is to actually address those concerns and work together to develop, in many cases, signed socioeconomic agreements between oil companies and First Nations that would determine what mitigation measures, for example, the oil company needs to take in order to meet the environmental requirements of the First Nation or provide jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And the other dimension of this is that in many cases there's issues outstanding between the First Nation and the Crown as to what the First Nation will get in terms of compensation for resource development in their traditional land area. So in the case that's being referred to here, and I don't think she's even listening to my answer. Is she? No, she's not. Okay. Are you listening to my answer? Okay, because it seems like you're talking. So, no, I'm just actually wondering why. I just feel like I'm trying to put a lot of mental energy into answering this question,
okay,
and she's not listening.
All right.
So, just in conclusion, I would say that in many cases, the primary issue here is actually between the Crown and First Nations and large unresolved issues. So I think in the court cases you're citing, actually the oil companies are not named, that actually it's a fiduciary duty to consult issue between the First Nation and the Crown, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, let's go to another question. There was a gentleman, did you still want to ask yours? Because you were up last time, too.
Steve Johnson, going back to the transportation.
Sorry, what organization
are you with? Verisco Productions, an independent production company.
Okay.
Going back to the transportation of the modules that was in the story this morning, it was a big question about the timing of it. It seemed like there was a question that might go on for 2020, not just for a year. That seemed to be quite a different point than just shutting down the roads for a year. So, can you speak to that, please?
So, did everyone hear that question? It has to do with the movement of processed vessels through the highways in Montana and Idaho, and whether or not that was going to continue for 10 to 20 years or not.
I can only say that I read the comments from Imperial Oil in the newspaper, and it seems like there's a disagreement between what Imperial Oil believes they have committed to in terms of a contract and what they have bought and when it will be delivered, and what perhaps the manufacturer believes it has sold and will have delivered, and the time frame there. My default is to know that only the first phase of CURL, which is the project in question, has been approved by the Imperial Oil ExxonMobil Board of Directors, and so therefore, just from a process perspective, they would not have the ability to make a financial commitment to 2020. So. I think there is a disagreement between the two facts, obviously, and I can't say where it is. But again, Imperial Oil is probably the best to comment on the details of their contract.
Okay, next question. Yes?
I'm Judith Lewis. I'm a freelance journalist and also contributing editor of High Country News. I've been reading a lot and hearing about the health impacts of the oil sands development already manifesting in some of the First Nations people up there, and I'm wondering if there have been studies confirming or dismissing, or if there's been any kind of definitive research on this study on those boats.
Okay, that was a question about how First Nations communities near or downstream of oil sands production have been impacted, and whether or not there have been any health studies looking at that issue. Who would like to take that?
I can't comment specifically on health issues because it's not something I know anything about, but I will comment on some of the studies that are ongoing and have occurred. So there was two studies that looked at contaminants in traditional foods, and those were done back early part of this decade and published. And they looked specifically at metals in things like deer meat and moose meat and traditional plants. That study is actually being enhanced as part of the government's comprehensive contaminant load study. We are building this health risk assessment multimedia model. It's a model out of the States here. It basically takes a look at all of the exposure pathways for humans and tries to get all the data that's required to go behind that, and it's really the data accumulation process that's the most important, because you could use it in any endeavor in terms of trying to piece out the individual impact pathways, but we're assembling it into basically this heuristic model that helps with the overall understanding of what all those little components are, or in this case very complex components, means. Alberta Health and Wellness has embarked on several studies. There was an external report done on cancer rates in Fort Chipewyan in relation to cancer rates expectations throughout Alberta, and that is available online as well. And they are continuing to work with the First Nations community to address how they could continue forward with additional health studies in that community.
Anyone else?
I would just add, and I'm not a doctor, but when I look at the concerns, health concerns in Fort Chipewyan, I know people in Fort Chipewyan, and I am concerned because they are concerned. And again, this is an area where we think new information needs to be brought to bear so that we can understand these issues. And in Canada, our health is care is delivered by the state, and residents of Fort Chipewyan deserve the same access to health care and to have their health care concerns addressed just like any other Albertan or any other Canadian.
I just want to add the Alberta Cancer Board report that was referenced was released in February 2009. I have the executive summary right here, and I'll just read to you. It says, the cancer rate overall, 51 cancers in 47 individuals, was higher than expected. They expected 39 cases. So there were higher than expected numbers of cancers of the blood and lymphatic system, biliary tract cancers as a group, and soft tissue cancers were found. The board went on, though, to state that these findings were based on a small number of cases and could be due to chance, increased detection, or increased risk in the community. So the community, I've talked to the community members a fair amount over the last couple of years.
Here, the situation where industry should be regulating itself and the movement of these very large pieces of equipment is one where we do deeply seek to be in compliance with the law, and we look for the regulators in each jurisdiction to tell us how they want us to work.
Yes, in the front.
My name is Jeff Galis. I'm from actually from Alberta, from Calgary. I grew up in Calgary, and I guess
Jeff. What?
I'm a freelance writer and author.
Thanks.
And my question to all of you is whether or not we need an improvement in the whole regulatory framework at both provincial and federal levels to be able to come to grips with a project like the oil sands. There's been I've done a lot of research. There's quite a bit of academic work been done on the degree to which Canada's environmental governance is some of the weakest in the developed world, and when you pile on top one of the biggest energy developments in the world, do we need to think about improving some of the legislation and regulation in Canada?
Okay, so the question basically, as I understood it, is that there's a, you know, obviously this is one of the biggest energy developments in the world, and do we need to strengthen provincial and federal regulations in order to manage that properly? Is that a correct representation? Okay. Who wants to take that one? We'll start with Peter.
Thank you. For those of you who are familiar with Canada, the concept of federal-provincial relationships is like a bad joke. It's been going on since Confederation. And that dictates, in large part, who can do what and to whom. And nevertheless, despite that, there has been put in place a fairly strong set of environmental tools that both federal and provincial governments can use. I think, from our perspective, the issue is not whether the tools are adequate. The issue is whether the political will exists to apply them, to actually push things to the limit to ensure that environmental protection receives as high a priority as economic development. And I think that's really what this issue is all about.
And I agree with Peter that the tools are there. They have to be modified for the specific... there is a lot of work that has to go on because they do have to be modified for the specifics of oil sands development. And I'm working on a number of those sorts of modifications right now within the Alberta government. So we're doing a review of the Water Act and how we allocate water in the province. So it's one of our major environmental acts that deals with the quantity issue around water. We've established a number of management frameworks which are sort of addendums that fall under the umbrella of our acts. The in-stream flow needs is a good example, which deals again with water scarcity. We brought in experts from around the world, most of them from the United States, some from Alaska, some from California, who are expert at dealing with water scarcity and the impacts to aquatic biota, and we established this management framework that's required for industry so they don't take too much water. And that falls under the umbrella of the Water Act. These sort of things are going on. The tailings management framework, which I mentioned earlier, which we're working on, again, this is under that umbrella of progressive reclamation. It falls under our APEA Act, which is the overall regulatory component of that. And it's basically that modification. How do you deal with this new issue that we haven't seen before, which are fine clay tailings in a fluid? So yes, a lot of work to do, and we're doing a lot of it. And it's going to take a long time to, well, fairly long time anyways, as we move forward. As I was saying, this is a show us and we learn as we go on a number of these things.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, I mean, my, you know...
And, sorry, can you make sure that we're all not holding the mic close enough?
Oh, sorry. So I guess just to build on that, I mean, my sense is that the scale and scope of the oil sands project is so large and the impact is so great that I think the bar for what effective regulation is ought to be very high. And I think my perspective is that the province is far from meeting that bar, at least at present, both in terms of the regulations and follow through and enforcement, which I think is equally important. You know, again, I think there's a real financial rationale to having solid regulation up front, so you don't continually kind of move the bar as its development happens. You know, I think you want to set the rules now, set the rules as rigorously as possible, so that investment can happen in a way that protects the environment. You know, I think you look at the current kind of regulatory environment in Alberta, and you know, while there is regulation around greenhouse gases, I think there's lots of ways it needs to be strengthened. It's an intensity target. It doesn't, you know, it's you can get out of it by paying into this technology fund. So there's no guarantee that the current regulatory environment actually reduces emissions over time. But I think on water, you know, there are kind of frameworks around water use. But you know, my understanding is that they're essentially in the end a voluntary framework. There isn't a regulatory stick you can use in the end to actually guarantee that, you know, low flow is protected. You know, there aren't kind of hard caps on things like air emissions. So, you know, I think there's a lot more that needs to be done. And then when it comes to are the regulations being followed through on, I think, you know, there is a lot of you know, the new tailings directive that came out a while ago now, again, Directive 74, I think people saw that as a step forward. Look, if we're going to regulate tailings in a significant way for the first time. And, you know, while on the one hand, that has actually stimulated some real technological innovation by some companies, you know, we're also seeing the regulatory body, the ERCB, you know, approving tailings management plans that explicitly don't comply with the law. So, you know, what does that mean? You know, you look at Exxon or Imperial, and they have a very interesting chart on their website where they talk about tailings reclamation. And they have a chart that shows all their projects. It shows the kind of the timeline and goals that the regulation set out, and it shows the plan that they submitted and the timeline and goals. And so they're very upfront saying, look, we can't meet the regulation, but we're going to do that anyways. So, you know, how does that look to the outsider when you have, you know, you make a big deal out of the strong new regulation around tailings, and then you don't, you know, follow the letter of the law? So I think that's certainly a concern as well.
I have to comment on that one. I just two things. First of all, I was intimately, I was a primary author on the water management framework, and it's not voluntary. I don't know how that got out there, but it does come under the Water Act, and it is a regulated requirement. That said, one of the things, and this is the same across the board with our stuff, is that you really have difficulty managing that which you can't measure accurately. So that's been one of the follow-throughs over the last 2 years is how do you get accurate measurement? If you're managing water flow to a 1 cubic meter per second and your error in a river this large is 5 or 10, how do you do that? So there are some challenges. I'm not debating that as much as that we do have the regulations there. With respect to Directive 74, this is an excellent example of where we pushed the bar perhaps a little too far. And it's not about them not meeting it. They are going to meet it. They have to meet it. It's about how much time they have to meet it. So the requirements for basically turning their tailings solid kick in at 2012 and march forward to 2015, and it requires massive amounts of infrastructure to centrifuge, to dry, to add polymer, to all do all these things that the companies just physically cannot build in the time frame required there. So CNRL, good example. They've been approved. They're going to exceed their targets under Directive 74, but they're going to enhance their processing rates so they get back to the line that they were regulated to originally. It's just that they're going to have this bump, and then they get back to what they're expected to achieve. The directive, as it's this tailings directive, is a major, major improvement. It's halving the volume of fluid fine tailings out there in the landscape. And that's a major commitment. We're talking companies processing over 30 million or more cubic meters of this stuff a year. Huge financial investment, huge infrastructure, huge additional terrestrial disturbance to do those sorts of things, because you have to put these tailings somewhere when they're dry and start the reclamation process. So all of these different trade-offs have to be measured and assessed.
I'm just aware of the time here, and I think Peter, you had one brief comment to make, or did you want to add something? Or
just an offer that we started out talking about this study that we published. I'm not sure how many of you have read it, but even I find it confusing at times. So I have some extra copies if people want to get confused. I also have some press releases that were issued by the University of Alberta when it was first released, and I'd be more than happy to talk to people and explain it after this meeting.
Great. That was a perfect conclusion. There's also some literature at the back, I believe, from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. Oh, sorry, Ceres, yeah. And the Alberta Environment. I want to thank all of you for coming to this session. I really, it's great to see such a large audience. And I just want to remind you guys that you should keep some feedback in mind. SCPA will be sending out evaluation and online survey, and if you'd like to give your thoughts, that would be the time. And now if I could just remind everyone that lunch is about to start in the ballroom. So thanks again.
Yes, I recognize the name.
Did I get your card?
Yes, I just grabbed some
questions. Okay, and also the study.